Deutsche Welle, Spotlight on Europe.
Many thanks for joining us here on Spotlight on Europe. It's always a pleasure to have you on board as we take a look at major events here in Europe, but from an African perspective. My name is Jane Nyinge, and in today's show, France introduces drones to catch dangerous drivers.
This kind of operation, we can stop from 15 to 20 trucks in an hour.
Also in the program, we'll hear the pain of being homeless here in Germany.
If you had told me 6 months ago I'd be sleeping on the street this winter, I'd say you've got the wrong guy. It's the kind of thing you have to live through for real to understand.
Well, stick around for those stories and much more. Many people on the African continent might imagine that homelessness doesn't exist in Europe, but that is in fact a myth. There is plenty of homelessness right here in Germany. And the number of homeless people continues to rise. And according to figures released last year, 860,000 people don't have a place to call home. One of the contributing factors to the current situation is the high cost of housing. So just how difficult is it for people who have lost their home to find a new one in Germany? And why do people end up losing their homes in the first place? Gabriel Borod went to downtown Bonn to find out more.
And ich habe mich getrennt von meiner Frau. Also meine Frau hat sich von mir getrennt.
I broke up with my wife. That is to say, my wife left me. And ever since, I've been looking for a new apartment. Right now, I'm living in this homeless shelter. It's so hard to find an apartment here.
Nicht gerne, das möchten die nicht, und kriegt man halt sehr schwer eine Wohnung hier in Bonn.
This is Jamal. He's 42 years old and on the street in Bonn. And on the verge of giving up.
Oh, yeah, bestimmt 30 Wohnungen. Kommt bestimmt hin. 30 Wohnungen habe ich nicht.
By now it's been at least 30 apartments I've looked at. Maybe if I use my connections, maybe then I'll get lucky. It's just really hard.
Let me just quickly tell you my version of Jamal's story, because his is like thousands, hundreds of thousands of others in the Federal Republic of Germany. I met him yesterday in Bonn while searching for somebody willing to talk about being homeless here. But when I met Jamal, all he was looking for was help with getting an apartment. If you ask him how it all happened, that he's on the street, he pauses, and it seems like he can't even tell you why. But he will say it all happened faster than he could have ever imagined.
Es kam halt von heute auf morgen. Ich meine, Beziehungen sind heute nicht mehr so sicher. Wir leben in einer Wegwerfgesellschaft. Das ist von heute auf morgen.
It happened from one day to the next. Relationships aren't as stable as they used to be, I guess. We are living in a world where you can be thrown away even by the people you love. And now I'm living in this homeless shelter. And who knows, there are rules here too. I'm a drug addict, it's true. And I can relapse at any time. And when that happens, maybe they'll throw me out, and then I'd be completely on the street. That would be even worse. If you had told me 6 months ago I'd be sleeping on the street this winter, I'd say you've got the wrong guy. It's the kind of thing you have to live through for real to understand. It looks a lot different looking at it from the outside.
One of the social workers at the shelter where Jamal and dozens like him are living these days is Ricarda Miebach.
The situation is serious, yes. We're aware that some people need long-term help. They're dependent on this. Because of their addiction or psychological needs, they can't live alone. And then it's our responsibility to give this person a home so that they can live here for as long as that person needs.
Der Mensch bekommt eine Bleibe bis hin dazu, dass er wirklich für immer bleiben kann.
When the living space is scarce, like you say, are there fights between the homeless and, let's say, new people who are coming to Germany, let's say refugees who are being given living space? Is that something that angers the people who are homeless here that you deal with on a daily basis?
Ja, ich glaube, also Kämpfe oder Konflikte in dem Sinne gibt es erstmal nicht.
Fights? Conflict? No, I don't think there are fights between the homeless here and the refugees. But I do think there is a lack of understanding. The homeless here are concerned with their own situation, their own struggle to survive. There's no rage or trouble with the refugees. That's not what it's about.
If you ask Helmut outside about how the homeless view the situation with the refugees, he'll tell you a different story than we've just heard.
Und frag nicht nach Sonnenschein, ich wollte nur nicht so krass ausdrücken. Das ist schon gar nein mehr, das ist schon Hass. Entschuldigung, das ist regelrechter Hass.
Are you kidding me? It's more than just envy, it's hatred. I'm sorry if I have to be the one who says it. It's real hatred. And it's going to escalate. It already has escalated, but nobody pays attention to us. We're just brushed under the rug. Of course, there's envy and hatred. When I think about these new people and what they get and how they can't behave, and then I see elderly women, 70 or 80 years old, who are collecting cans to get by, I must say, I get rage in my eyes. These women were the ones who rebuilt our country from the ashes, and they don't get a pension. I thought this country was rich. I thought we were the export world champions. Where are these billions? Where are they?
Helmut has been here for decades. He and his friend Doza are self-proclaimed punks, part of the older generation in the Bonn homeless scene. His friend Doza, a nickname that implies beer can in German, can tell you a thing or two about living on the street.
Man trinkt gemütlichen Bier, man trinkt auch zwei Bier, und blöderweise auch ein drittes.
You drink one beer, then you drink another beer, and stupidly you drink a third. That's what my days have become. You ask me what it's like to live with nothing, it's crap, to the power of three. But we've just gotten used to it. And maybe that's the worst thing of all, that we've just gotten used to it. We've just come to grips.
Hat man sich damit abgefunden.
As Doza downs another plastic bottle of cheap beer, probably his fourth or fifth, and it's not even 10:30 in the morning, it's hard not to feel for the guy. There are more and more people like this in Germany who are just watching their lives fly by. As daunting as the task seems, of trying to help people like Doza somehow hang on, Ricarda Miebach from the shelter says this is precisely her calling, because what's going on outside her office, she says, is not a parallel world.
Nein. Ganz klar würde ich das mit einem Nein beantworten.
No, no doubt about it. The answer is no. This is not a parallel world. These people dream of the very things we all dream of, and giving them a chance is what our work is all about. Nobody wants to live in a parallel world. And if these people can't make it on their own, then we'll help them avoid that parallel world, so that they, like you and me and everyone else, can live in our world together.
Dass es eben keine Parallelwelt wird, sondern dass man wie du und ich, wie jeder miteinander leben kann.
Ricarda Miebach ending that report by Gabriel Borad. To Spain now, and the Catalonia region will vote in a crucial election on the 21st of December. The poll comes after months of turmoil following a referendum on the 1st of October that led to the then Catalonian president Carles Puigdemont declaring independence. Madrid then dismissed the Catalan government and suspended the region's autonomy. Puigdemont and other Catalan leaders fled to Belgium, where they are until today. Our Spain correspondent is Guy Hedgeco, and Inside Europe's Keith Walker asked him who might win the election.
Well, it's very delicately balanced at the moment. You have three pro-independence parties on the one hand, and then on the other side you have three pro-unity parties. And they really are fighting it out at the moment. It looks as if together, if they put their seats and their votes together, the pro-independence parties are more likely to win on December the 21st, but they could struggle to form a government, to have a majority. So it may be the case that together they gain more seats than the unionist parties, but then fail to form a government. And there is a possibility that the unionist parties could form a government even if they lose by getting the support of other parties. So it's very delicately balanced at the moment.
Okay, and then is there any chance that the pro-independence parties might try to repeat their secessionist drive after the election on the 21st of December?
I think that's very unlikely, at least a repeat of the kind of sort of strident independence drive that we saw in the autumn. I think that the pro-independence parties are rather bruised still from the failure of that attempt to break away from Spain. Several politicians are now in prison. Carles Puigdemont, the deposed president of Catalonia, is in exile in Belgium. And perhaps most significant of all, Catalonia is being governed from Madrid in an unprecedented move. The Spanish government introduced direct rule. So there is a feeling that the independence movement is very much on the back foot and is trying to sort of gather itself and try and work out how in the future it might move towards independence. But there is a feeling that if they do that, they will be much more cautious about it, perhaps much less unilateral in the way they go about it. So it's very unlikely we'll see those kinds of scenes, I think, in the coming weeks, even if the pro-independence parties do win.
Puigdemont is in exile in Belgium, as you say, and he's been leading the campaign from there. He's also led a march of around 45,000 people who went from Catalonia to Belgium. I mean, that shows a huge amount of support for him. How long is he going to stay in Belgium for?
Well, the answer is we don't know at the moment. Puigdemont himself has been campaigning very actively from his exile, and it's made it a very unusual election campaign. And he has said that if he wins this election, which is looking unlikely but not impossible, if his PD Cat party were to win, then he would return, and he would, as he puts it, you know, return as the rightful president of Catalonia. And he's been insisting all along that he was illegitimately removed from the post back in October. So he has been able to rally a lot of support, basically because of the fact that he's in exile. He's used that in his favour to say that this is a repression of the Spanish state. This is why we're fighting for independence. And the fact that he's in exile does seem to be working in his party's favour.
What's the vibe on the streets like at the moment? Because on October 1st, there was a lot of violence. There was some 900 people injured. So are we going to see a repeat of that? Or, you know, have things simmered down somewhat?
So far, it's been, sort of, relatively speaking, a fairly calm campaign. We haven't seen the kind of scenes that we saw back in October, which was so unusual and so unprecedented. You know, the police violence, the thousands of people out on the street, that was really unusual. But I think the Spanish government and the Spanish authorities are going to be very cautious about how they respond if there are demonstrations out in the street. They certainly don't want to see a repeat of what happened on October the 1st with those scenes of police violence, because that was such a bad PR incident for the Spanish government and for the Spanish authorities. I think they realised it was a big mistake.
Guy Hedgeco there speaking to Inside Europe's Keith Walker on the Spain's Catalonia region crucial election that will be held on the 21st of this month. The European Union leaders say Israeli government officials are always welcome in Brussels, but none had visited for 22 years before Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu arrived on Monday to attend a foreign ministers' meeting. It was something of a fluke. The visit happened at all, as it stemmed from a personal invitation by the Lithuanian foreign minister that was then formalized by European Commission Vice President Federica Mogherini when she heard about it. As Terry Schutz reports from Brussels, Netanyahu's appearance turned out to be the opposite of a courtesy call.
Netanyahu packed a bag full of chutzpah for his first official visit to the European Union capital. After a terse handshake with EU foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini, who reportedly wasn't happy Lithuania had unilaterally made the invitation, the two met journalists to deliver remarks. Netanyahu thanked Vilnius for the invite, then highly praised the Trump administration's decision to declare Jerusalem Israel's capital, an action vigorously denounced by all EU leaders, which has caused riots across the region.
I think what President Trump has done is put facts squarely on the table. Peace is based on reality. Jerusalem is Israel's capital. No one can deny it. It makes peace possible.
And he didn't stop there.
I believe that all or most of the European countries will move their embassies to Jerusalem, recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital.
That was too much for Mogherini. The EU's top diplomat made clear in a news conference later, neither EU governments nor their embassies are budging on the matter of Jerusalem until there's a two-state solution based on UN principles, with Palestinians sharing the capital.
I know that Prime Minister Netanyahu mentioned a couple of times that he expects others to follow President Trump's decision to move the embassy to Jerusalem. He can keep his expectations for others, because from the European Union member state side, this move will not come.
Mogherini made sure to mention at every opportunity that she's invited Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas to come next month. Meanwhile, the U.S. is plowing ahead with a new peace plan to follow up on the Jerusalem issue. That should make EU leaders nervous, says Martin Konechny, who runs the European Middle East Project, a new nonpartisan policy shop in Brussels, promoting increased EU efforts for resolving the conflict.
The Europeans have just quite clearly and strongly criticized the Trump administration for the move on Jerusalem. But at the same time, they are pushing them and encouraging them to propose this peace plan as if that peace plan is going to be in line with the EU's understandings and the international consensus on what a two-state solution should look like. And I think anyone who has followed the Trump administration's actions on Israel-Palestine so far should be actually very worried about what will be in such a peace plan.
Mogherini emphasizes the EU is not simply sitting around with a waiting for Godot attitude for the U.S. ideas. However, she acknowledges there's no new EU initiative in the works attempting to crack the Israeli-Palestinian stalemate. Even without their own new ideas, Konechny tells DW, the EU should be warning Washington it will not, as Netanyahu suggested, just follow the Trump administration. But Stefan Lehne with Carnegie Europe believes that may be expecting too much from EU diplomacy, which he says is continually weakened by each member state wanting to make its own national mark, not letting the EU forge its own identity. Lehne has just written a paper titled, Is There Hope for EU Foreign Policy? And when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, he believes there really isn't much. Instead of trying to wedge its way into a process with what he believes are pretty dismal chances for success, Lehne suggests the EU change its focus to one of the many other problems in the Middle East and North Africa.
I think one has to get one's priorities right. One cannot try everything. From my point of view, probably Syria and Libya at the moment more promising.
When Syria and Libya are considered the more promising opportunities, it makes clear just how intractable the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is and how much more energetic EU foreign policy needs to become. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
Well, if you've just joined us, this is Spotlight on Europe coming to you from Bonn, Germany. And yes, you can keep on talking to us on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Let's now cross over to Greece. And 10 years after the first same-sex civil marriage was performed on a tiny island in Greece, the country's Supreme Court has ruled to annul the union. Greece remains one of the last countries in Europe to bar same-sex marriages. But as Anthi Karasava reports from Athens, activists want to push Greece out of what they call its primitive mindset.
10 years ago, Dimitris Tabrounis and Themistocles Katayanis defied long-standing tradition here and warnings from the state, tying instead the knot on a remote Greek island. It was the only place the two men could find a mayor liberal enough to perform the small, no-frills, but unprecedented same-sex union. Now Greece's highest court has ruled that the wedding was illegal, capping a lengthy and costly legal battle. But the couple, bent on living happily ever after, says it will take its case to the highest court of human rights in Europe to win the right to wed. The couple plans to launch legal proceedings next month. Greek gay rights groups have noted a loophole in the 1982 law that does not specify that a civil union must involve a man and a woman. Any constitutional expert here, though, will tell you the argument is weak. While Greece has recently upgraded its laws in recognizing same-sex partnerships, marriage still remains illegal, and that, experts say, because in this country, matrimony is still largely, if not exclusively, defined as a union between a man and a woman with the intent of forming a family. The country's powerful Orthodox Church has a major role also in molding Greek minds and perceptions. Unlike other European countries, the Church and the state here have yet to divorce. Worst yet, the Church refuses to acknowledge the prospect of same-sex marriages, billing homosexuality a sin and a defect of human nature. Greeks appear to agree, remaining silent than accepting change. In fact, for all its openness and flourishing gay tourism, Greek society remains largely homophobic. Public displays of homosexual affection are widely frowned upon, and the country's military bars gay men and lesbians from joining its ranks. Private media have also been slapped with hefty fines for showing gay scenes. In one instance years ago, a local television station was fined about €100,000 by the State Radio and Television Regulating Commission showing men kissing in a weekly drama. Since the Supreme Court ruling issued its decision, the Greek Church has offered no comment, nor have any local media or politicians taken issue with the decision to fan public debate. It's unlikely anyone will. With an election year due to soon kick off, any landmark decision in favor of the gay couple could spell heated protests and political unrest. Anthika Rasava, DW, Athens.
Now, if traffic drones were to be introduced in Africa, would this be a solution to the reduction of road carnage witnessed each year? Perhaps. But this project has already been introduced in France, and in a short period of time, hundreds of careless drivers have been fined thanks to the spy in the sky. From France, John Laurenson reports.
A drone climbs into the sky to fix its glass eye on the busy Bordeaux Beltway. On the ground, police captain Pascal Jansou scrutinises the images it's sending down to the monitor. We're in a quiet road that's next to the highway, but hidden from it by trees.
The drone is very useful because we can see dangerous drivers on the roads without being seen by them.
Today, they're going after truckers.
Dangerous behaviours like unrespecting distances of security or forbidden overtaking.
He doesn't have to wait long. White truck, red and black letters on the side. Illegal passing, he says into his walkie-talkie.
Dépassement interdit.
Motorcycle cops waiting down the road from the drone zone receive the description and move to intercept.
This kind of operation today, we can stop from 15 to 20 trucks in an hour.
The road safety campaigner Christophe Ramonde of the lobby group Prévention Routière says it's great.
What's good about this is that it enables us to identify dangerous driving that goes unseen and unsanctioned at the moment. If you just look at accidents involving heavy goods vehicles, we have between 700 and 800 fatalities a year in France due to accidents involving trucks. So it is definitely useful to make sure truck drivers respect the minimum safety distance with the vehicle in front and do not drive dangerously.
Ramon tells me research shows that repressive measures are needed to change driver behaviour. Drivers, on the other hand, can be expected to grumble. Speed cameras already earn the French government $750 million a year in fines. In comparison, in the UK, with a roughly equivalent population, speed cameras earn the government about seven times less. For Pierre Chasseret of the lobby group 40 Million Drivers, traffic drones are an unwelcome escalation on what he says is a sort of war on drivers.
C'est quand même fou qu'on soit toujours dans la démesure en train d'imaginer des nouveaux systèmes répressifs en France.
It's amazing how inventive we are in France when it comes to finding new forms of repression. Just think, instead of encouraging drivers to keep their eyes on the roads, we now have to look at the side of the road for speed cameras, and now in the air for drones. Maybe the next step will be to send in the Air Force.
Chasseret would prefer prevention, he says. More road safety awareness campaigns, for example. In any event, the drone is nabbing drivers like this trucker I spoke to as he paid his fine. How much is it then, sir? 90 euros, he says. What did they say you did? They got me with a swallow. The drone, or whatever it is, caught me overtaking. You weren't expecting that? No, if I'd been expecting it, I wouldn't have been stupid enough to overtake. It's good, he's taking it well, says the policeman as he fiddles with the credit card terminal. What you expect, says the driver, I'm not going to cry. Perhaps a good attitude. The federal government likes the look of the Bordeaux drone experiment. It says it's looking into purchasing drones in order to bring similar traffic surveillance operations to other parts of the country. John Morrison, DW, Bordeaux, France.
And finally, to our roundup of European news, and human rights group Amnesty International has accused EU governments of supporting migrants' abuse in Libya. Amnesty says that the bloc is complicit in the widespread abuse of migrants by the Tripoli government, as well as smugglers and armed groups. Helen Sini has the details in this roundup of European news.
Amnesty said Tuesday that the EU is complicit in the abuse of tens of thousands of migrants in Libya in order to stem migration from North Africa. The human rights group said European governments are training and funding the Libyan Coast Guard to intercept migrants at sea who are then sent to detention centres where they're subject to abuse. Led by Italy, the EU has been providing technical and financial support to the Libyan Coast Guard and immigration authorities in a bid to stop migrants, mostly from West Africa, from using Libya as a launch pad to reach Europe with the help of human smugglers. According to the EU's border agency, Frontex, there's been a one-third drop in migrant arrivals through the central Mediterranean in the first 11 months of this year. Much of that decline has been since summer, when Italy moved to expand cooperation with Libya. The EU has rejected criticism of its Libya policy. It recently moved to increase funding for detained migrants and improve conditions after reports of abuses and migrants being sold into slavery. The bloc has also tried to accelerate the repatriation of migrants from Libya to their countries of origin. French President Emmanuel Macron hosted a global climate summit in Paris on Tuesday. The One Planet conference was aimed at mobilising new projects and financial commitments to combat climate change. Macron has been one of the most prominent critics of US President Donald Trump's decision to pull out of the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. At Tuesday's summit, more than 50 world, political and business leaders pledged to align investment decisions with climate goals. Trump wasn't invited, but American officials, such as former U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, insisted that the world will shift to cleaner fuels and reduce emissions, regardless of whether the Trump administration pitches in. One of the most significant announcements at the summit was from the World Bank, which announced it would no longer support investments in oil or gas exploration, drilling and extraction, except in exceptional cases for poorer countries. 25 EU member states have formally agreed to establish a new defence and security network called PESCO. It allows closer cooperation to develop joint military capabilities and is meant to make the EU less dependent on the US for its security needs. The cooperation will lay the foundation for a proposed European Defence Union. Participating countries will begin working on a series of joint projects next year. Officials have earmarked 17 initial projects. They include establishing a medical unit, a pan-European military training centre, introducing common standards for military radio communication, and a logistics hub. The EU's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, says the new agreement is historic.
Helen Sini with that roundup of European news.
Kepler 45 2B. DJ Mopao, Frontieri Aliwa.
Karanga photo!
Tuturoba.
Well, that's where we end today's show. Don't forget, if you missed any bit of the show or you want to listen again, you can visit our website DW Africa or our Facebook page DW Africa. On behalf of the entire team here in Bonn, Germany, my name is Jen Nyinge. Thank you so, so much for your time.
Ahmed Obakayoko, l'homme du peuple.
Amio! Chuma, amio!
Mila lobis to pe.
Aleta poise.
Jean-François Ndenge. Ndenge lobis to pe. Eba!
Aleta poise.
Jean-François.
Vincent Gomez, Alexis.
Il a lobbyiste payé.
Patrick Kimuta, Gisèle Ardioli.
Il a lobbyiste payé.
Et le boss Paul Obambi.
Sois la photo. Tous ces camoquets.